We tend to put our watches in people's hands and, you know, it becomes about the textures, the weight, the junctions, the physicality, the double-domed glass, the textural 3D element into the dial. And a lot of these aspects are very, very hard to communicate in photography and description as well.
We meet the product design consultant who's dreaming of honing the designs of Swiss-made watches to sell, of course, but also to hold up as a calling card for corporate clients seeking his smart services. All that to come right here on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also today...
It's not easy to work in the design industry in this region, as there are other priorities for the governments, for the authorities. So the limited resources, those tight conditions, actually are creating more creative ideas. And that's why you see it as a trend, actually.
We'll discover how Jordan, that non-literal island of creativity and comparative liberalism in the region, is tempting talent and reshaping the design scene in the Middle East. Plus,
we have a whole area which is called the clay pit, so you can actually come and get clay under your fingernails. You can really mess about with slip, great big sausages of clay, make work with it, which is part of our engagement programme. It's very much about doing stuff with clay. It's about demonstrations and workshops.
We'll toss a pot or two and get our hands dirty at the British Ceramics Biennial. All that coming up here on Section D on Monocle 24. In just its second annual outing, the Amman Design Week attracted tens of thousands of visitors to Jordan last week for a cluster of creative events orbiting around a central space known as the Hangar. Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, was on hand to eyeball the exhibition and was particularly taken by a series of installations tied to the theme of movement. Nolan began by talking to designer Rula Yagamore of the company Cutler.
This project is called Kutleh, and this is the first adaptation of Kutleh. It's a chair. The idea is to create a new material out of the surplus from the stone industry, slabs of marble, granite and stone, all compressed together to create something different and something new from recycled materials. A whole block was created, and Kutleh actually means mass, block of stone. A whole mass was created and then carved by CNC machines and robots to create this form of the chair.
And it's an interesting form. I mean, you said it's a chair, but it's almost like a couch in a way, or a bed. You can lie right down on it.
Yes. Some form of a recliner. Originally, it was designed by Ronnie Horn. She's an artist. She used to do experiments in concrete in the 60s. So this chair model was used to experiment concrete. So that's why I decided to use the design to experiment a new material. Because this material actually was inspired from laminated wood. The idea of having planes of wood compressed together is already there. But having it in marble and stone is not there yet. So that was the main inspiration. And using the chair that was used for experimentation really helped me in producing something beautiful.
And so basically you're using wastage, really. You're
yes.
actually helping the industry get rid of, you know, what is just something they're going to throw away, and you're turning it into something of value.
Exactly. Actually, my husband works in the stone industry, and whenever I visit their factory and their fabrication factory, I see a big plot of land. They call it the graveyard because it has all the waste. But I always tell him there's a lot of potential in this graveyard. Actually, a lot of life, a lot of things that are living. So that helped me to create this idea.
And I mean, looking around us, we know we're surrounded by amazing design, and there seems to be quite a strong focus on sustainability and using recyclable materials and things like that. Is that something of a trend at this event? Is that something a lot of designers in this part of the world are thinking about right now?
Actually, we're living in a place where the resources are very limited. The budgets are always tight. It's not easy to work in the design industry in this region, as there are other priorities for the governments, for the authorities. So the limited resources, those tight conditions, actually are creating more creative ideas. And that's why you see it as a trend, actually.
Continuing further into the hangar, I meet designer Ahmed Sabah, part of a creative collective whose interactive installation shows a timeline and a map of the nation's waterways. It sits in a basin of water and beautifully conveys an alarming message about water scarcity in Jordan.
Okay, originally the idea came because the theme of the exhibition is about movement. So we thought, what about movement of resources? The curator actually of this exhibition, Ahmed Hamed, suggested we wanted to do something else, to be honest, about transportation. And they said, why not to highlight the problem of water on Jordan, since we're thinking of movement on the map, you know? So this is how we connected our work to the theme. I mean, this work was done by 5 designers. 3 of us are designers, and 1, Iyas, is a programmer, and Bashir is a researcher. Took us only 3 months. The hardest thing was to collect the data, because we really have very little data available online. It was a challenge, but it was a nice project to work on.
It seems like a lot of these installations here are dealing with, you know, issues facing the environment, particularly here in the Middle East. How important is it for designers here to be dealing with this?
Well, it is very important. As I said, I mean, we as designers, we can only research or read about any problem, you know, and try to visualize it in a way that people can interact with, you know, and or can easily, you know, observe this problem. Now, a lot of people ask about the solution, you know, but I always say, like, we're not experts to suggest any solutions. Okay, as a human, we can read and make up our own opinion, definitely, you know, but this piece, the aim of this piece is just to leave awareness. Maybe it's a bit dark, but the fact it's, the problem is very big, we can't be just happy about it. It should be dark. We should leave people with a dark message. This is what I think.
But that being said, you know, it's very busy. People are very interested. You're obviously getting a good feedback to this.
Yeah, obviously we're getting good feedback, because people, they think that this is an important issue. I mean, people are agreeing that this is an important issue. And to be honest, the nicest thing that's happened here in this room, as you see, the small conversation that sparked around this table, you know, people are talking about the problem, talking about the water. Like, you have like older people coming and saying, like, I remember when this dam was built, and this, we were saying this, until now we're seeing this, you know. So the conversation that sparked around this table, to me, is the most interesting thing. I think this is where we achieved our goal, you know, to spread this awareness about the problem.
A more abstract approach to analyzing this same topic is taken by designer Riyad Yocca, part of the Middle East Architecture Network, or MEAN.
What we do as architects, we look at natural phenomena. That's this kind of the process that we take. So we've looked at the natural phenomena of cracking that happens on Earth once you have dryness. The name of the piece is Arid, and it represents that sort of phenomena. So we abstracted an algorithm that is a mathematical formula of how cracking works in nature, and we simulated that digitally. And through that, we got 120 unique pieces that interlock. Those pieces have been milled out of natural limestone using a robotic arm, which we got access to in Sahab here in Jordan, which was very fascinating for us to be able to do that advanced kind of and complex work in Jordan. The piece is assembled onto a steel base that has been rusted, and the steel has also been digitally manufactured for precision. And also, the way we've designed the piece is that it comes apart in pieces. We designed the installation to come apart in pieces so that we can deinstall it and reinstall it at a home where it could help spread the message over time.
And how important is it for you as a designer here in Jordan to kind of be raising awareness to the general public? Because it seems like not just you guys, but a number of other designers here are taking on similar messages and similar challenges and really educating the public on the issues that are going on.
Definitely. As an architect that's been that has studied and trained abroad, coming back here with a set of skills that is sort of a niche sort of set of skills, I really wanted to use those skills to raise questions and to address issues that we have in the country. It's a very important sort of stream of work, which we call, as part of MEAN, we call it social design. And the reason for that is that we don't want to be alienated from the society and the culture, as you see here in Amman Design Week. It's open to public. anyone from the suite can come in free of charge and look at the work. And you need to relate to the 99% of the population that doesn't have a design education or design background, but in the same time, relate to them in a way that addresses these major issues that we have in the country, whether it's global warming, political issues, issues such as water scarcity. I think that's a very important message to send, that design could really move these issues forward and could make them more accessible for people to get familiar with.
Our thanks to Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, for that report from Amman Design Week. The event concluded in the Jordanian capital on Sunday. Now, as a quick aside, perhaps no other piece of technology has stood the test of time quite like the humble watch. Most experts agree that the world's oldest working clock is that of Salisbury Cathedral, right here in the United Kingdom, which has been keeping townsfolk ticking since around 1386. It took about two centuries for clocks to make the leap from towers to people, when the earliest known wristwatch was gifted to Queen Elizabeth I. And with their ingenious mechanisms designed to tick into eternity, it's easy to understand why a well-made timepiece is still a popular accessory. The metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Ryland. He's at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Please do stay tuned. The Swiss-made timepieces created by Jared Mankalov's design studio come watch brand Objest are an attractive thing and come at the shadow of a price of those made by competitors. The Hatch Plus automatic model is priced in the hundreds rather than the thousands and features a double-domed sapphire glass front, a date window and a crisscross of geometric patterns on its dial, plus, of course, a few colourful touches on the crown, buckles and hands for a spot of levity. I sat down with the founder of Objest, Jared Mankalov, to talk about the tribulations of product design and why his dream of dabbling in watchmaking helped the rest of his business stay current.
A watch is almost the perfect thing for us. It's very analog, it's tangible, and what it does is capture elements of colours, materials and finishes that we use in some of the other projects that we work in, both object and lifestyle products. And there's also a very strong story behind some of the dials that we've developed as well.
It strikes me that many aspects of design, or one of the most important decisions, is often what to leave out of what you don't need to include when you're doing a product. What was the stage where you sat down? Did you have a blank piece of paper in front of you and you thought, well, I know the shape of a watch, but now what to do with it? Can you tell me a little bit about the journey of how you developed the watches to what they are today?
Exactly. I mean, our mandate or principles were to be simple, modern and Swiss. And, you know, we wanted to basically design all of the components on the watch, so nothing off the shelf. And, you know, we draw a lot of influences from Japanese culture, so designers like Izumiaki, kind of folding, pleating, scoring aspects, along with some of the playful kind of gestural elements that you'll see in designers like Jamie Hayon, Mark Newson as well. So we started with a very soft, pebble-like form to the watch, and then wanted to add this kind of narrative aspect into the dial. So, you know, very simple, very minimal in its kind of surface treatment, and then kind of going back in, adding these stories to the numberless dials. So that's where it really came about.
So tell me, is the watch a passion project, a thing that you've always wanted to do, or is it a calling card for the services that you offer as a company, or you know, can it be both?
I think it's both. I mean, it's absolutely one of these products that does capture colours, materials and finishes. It is about product design. You know, it's about brand as well. And it's all of these things that get embodied into one product. And I think sometimes it's quite hard for product designers or design consultancies to really communicate the value that they do invest or give back to clients. And I think, you know, this, for us, this consumer-facing brand Objest certainly does this, and it shows what we're about, who we are, and some of our values as a business.
And tell me a little bit about bringing the watch to market. You're obviously a consummate professional at designing the watch. They're beautiful objects, and you and I are lucky to have met one another a few times and to have featured the watches in the magazine. But I wonder, after all of the design, after all of the consultancy, after all of the kind of highfalutin talk, of, you know, what you want this to be, your great passion for the project, it's about physically getting it out there sometimes. It's about explaining to people over and over again at, say, trade shows or over email or contacting the right suppliers or stockists. How do you do that? What advice would you give to a listener who perhaps, like you, has a passion for product design, but is just that one stage behind you of kind of getting it out there, of getting it in front of the right people and making the right impression?
The biggest thing that we've found is it is hugely important to put the product into people's hands and to be talking to them about the brand. You know, we are very young and we are very small and we don't have any brand equity. And if you don't have any brand equity, then it's very hard to launch a product and for that to instantly resonate with consumers. So we've found it absolutely vital to be at trade events and to get the product into people's hands, because whether it be a piece of furniture, lighting, or in our case watches, consumers are comparing a front elevation of one watch with the front elevation of another watch if we're talking about e-commerce. And for us, it's not that, you know, we tend to put our watches in people's hands and, you know, it becomes about the textures, the weight, the junctions, the physicality, the double-domed glass, the textural 3D element into the dial. And a lot of these aspects are very, very hard to communicate in photography and description as well. So I would say get out there and talk to people, get feedback, both good and bad, and build on it.
And I'm interested a little bit in the design process as well. Is it easy to change hats from being a designer who puts himself and his knowledge of the materials that are being used, the colours, the finishes, into a product which you are creatively in control of, and then, say, talking to a brand about how they achieve their vision, which might be a little bit different for yours? Is it easy to switch between those two roles, that of a consultant and that of a designer who's pretty footloose to pursue the design as he sees it?
I guess for us it's very similar, because whether you're designing a light or a watch, you know, the process is very, very similar. It's about, you know, sketching stuff up, prototyping it very, very quickly, getting it in the hand, you know, iteration, and then getting feedback from people. So for us, whether it be consumer electronics, CMF development, or designing a watch, the workflow and process is very similar. One thing that we do always struggle with the watchmaking industry is it's quite archaic in terms of actually getting stuff produced, made, prototype. So for instance, if we're designing a small consumer electronics product, we can get something designed and very quickly tooled up within 6 weeks. Yet for us to get a case prototyped and developed, you know, we could be looking at 2 to 3 months, and it's just, you know, it's something that we find absolutely crazy. So these are all aspects that we're working on with 3D metal printing, standard 3D prototyping, just in terms of trying to speed the process up when we're making our watches and prototyping them.
And as a final question, before you came on air, you were telling me about the rigours of going through this prototyping. But what are the latest developments in the Objest world? What are the products that people are going to see should they encounter your brand over the next couple of months?
We are working on a range of furniture products, some other lifestyle products based on the home, lighting as well, and, you know, very much adhering to the same principles. So being very simple, modern, and, you know, being affordable for people as well.
Just as a final question, as it occurs to me, is there anything about kind of being in charge of your own destiny, doing your own product that's yours, that allows you to take a risk that you wouldn't take if you were, say, consulting on someone else's product? Is there a certain kind of freedom that you can pursue when the brand's all your own?
I think there's a lot of freedom. There's also there's also the opportunity to waste a lot of money as well, which I think you have to be very, very cautious of. I think with rapid prototyping processes and some of the other processes that we use, then we can get stuff made very, very quickly, quite cheaply. It doesn't mean to say that everything we do is good, but that's what this kind of process is very much about. It's been iterative and, you know, with key focus on trying to do stuff outside of the world of a consultant where you're very much dictated by a client's brief.
Jared Mankalov there, founder of design studio Objest, talking about the handsome new Hatch Plus watch, which is available now. First industrialised in the UK's West Midlands by Josiah Wedgwood, the craft of ceramics has perhaps counterintuitively found a toehold in the city in recent years. Forget vast kilns or homeware by the pallet load. Today, smaller scale potters are forming careers under railway arches and in overlooked post-industrial spaces. Maybe it's the singularity of the craft in an age of email updates and backlit screens, but more and more people are turning their hands and potter's wheels to the art and craft of ceramics. Now, the British Ceramics Biennial has taken over the UK centre of the trade, Stoke-on-Trent, and Monocle's very own intrepid producer, Ben Ryland, spoke to the event's executive director, Ian Cartwright, to find out a little more.
One of the things we do at the British Ceramics Biennial, as well as running the biennial 6 weeks every 2 years, is we run a whole range of engagement activities in Stoke. So working with schools and community groups. We also run our own, what we would call adult education, evening classes, if you like, in ceramics, because there weren't any. And we've seen a massive interest in that. People are making something and then actually sharing it on social media. And I think that's really part of the whole kind of resurgence in interest in ceramics. I think the other thing is that, and a thing that's key to Stoke, is that a lot of those things that are made by hand in Stoke. So often, a lot of the ceramics companies in Stoke say that a teacup has passed through 60 pairs of hands before it's finally produced, because there's all the different processes that it needs to go through in order to get to that finished product. And I think one of the things that the reason why there is a resurgence in the industry in Stoke is because those industries, those companies that stayed in the city and made a virtue of being the handcrafted, are the ones that are doing really well, and they're the ones that are selling around the world.
And that is a key part of the ceramics movement, I suppose you could call it. The fact that when you pick up something that is handmade, that has come from an actual person, you can see the design process in the finished product. That really does set it apart from one of those mass-produced things that you might buy at one of those big box megastores.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that we're trying to celebrate. If you were to come to the Biennial and see a whole with over 20 exhibitions with 100 artists, you'll see a massive range of interest in the material and the processes and the final product as well.
When I was looking through the programme, one thing that really interested me is something that's an exhibition surrounding the Brown Betty, which is the teapot.
Yeah.
And that is something that a lot of people would use many days of the week, I suppose.
Yeah.
Not really think about it all that much, but we all generally come into contact with ceramics at some point of the day, and the teapot is a key part of that. But the Brown Betty is an interesting design because it is a classic, but it's not necessarily one thing, is it? It's kind of evolved in all different directions over a long time.
Yeah, I think it's the archetypal brown teapot that everyone had. Certainly my grandmothers both had them. So it's the very kind of rotund, stubby, very brown, very utilitarian teapot that worked. You know, it made a great cup of tea and it was really practical, and they produced in something like 500,000 a week were produced in Stoke-on-Trent in its heyday.
It's an awful lot of tea.
That's a lot of tea, yeah. And I suppose that's that whole kind of thing about the kind of ritual of tea drinking and sharing tea with somebody is really important and really part of it. But the project that we've done with Ian McIntyre, who's been doing it as part of his PhD, is looking at the Brown Betty, which wasn't really designed over time. It just evolved almost. And it also perhaps got rather degraded as those designs were passed around between a number of different companies, to the point that what he's doing with the project is not redesigning it, but is kind of undesigning it, if you like, going back and looking at some of the things that have been lost along the way. So he's created and returned to the inverted spout. And also it's a spout that the idea is it doesn't drip. Another thing that he's gone back to is a lid actually locked in place. So when you tip up the teapot, the lid doesn't fall out.
I mean, this sounds like basic practicalities.
They sound like basic things, but they've been lost along the way somehow.
Which is so often happens in all sorts of design processes when, I suppose, people start chasing trends, they start chasing fashion, they just want to change it for the sake of changing it and refreshing it. And along the way, it becomes less practical, or practicality is just forgotten completely.
Yeah. And that's what I like about the project, is that Ian hasn't really gone for the kind of the flashy kind of designer end of things at all. He's gone for making it work, but also some tweaks. So he's put in, this is probably perhaps a nod to put more contemporary tea drinking tastes. He's also put it, there's a kind of mesh basket that you put drop inside the teapot in order to gather the tea leaves. And that's something that, you know, wouldn't have happened in the 1950s. He's also done a couple of things to make it much easier to stack if you're using it in catering or in a dishwasher, so that the water drains out of it more easily.
Do you still drink out of a Brown Betty?
Of course.
Good to know. So do I. Although mine is yellow, I must say. So aside from the brown Betty then, what are some of the other highlights of the biennial that we should be looking out for?
The main site is the old Spode site where the Spode factory produced bone china ware, the original bone china design and blue-white transfer ware. So it's a really important heritage site. But it's being regenerated, I suppose, partly by our activities, but there's also a range of other people doing other things, including Keith Brimer-Jones, who's hoping to re-establish a factory on the site, and he's looking to employ 40 or 50 people actually making tableware back again in Spode, which would be really, really good. Our two key shows, I suppose, is Award, which is a selected show. So we have a selection panel who rifled through about 150 people and made submissions, and we selected 10 of those. So their work is showing. It's kind of work that's never been shown before. That's a part of the process. It has been new work. And then the winner is going to be announced next week with a £5,000 prize. And the idea is that they then come back and represent their work in 2 years' time at the next biennial. Another show that we recurs each biennial is the Fresh Show. That's a call that we put out to all institutions across the UK and the Republic of Ireland. So it's new graduates' works for in 17, it's this year and obviously last year to get both years. And we make a selection from that. And we have 22 of their work, two of those artists on display. And if you like, that's the kind of best of new talent kind of coming through Art College and so on. And then the winner of that show is then given a month's residency with our Danish partners at an international ceramics research institute in Guldegard in Denmark. And then they bring their work back again in 19. We've also got a really interesting project with Neil Brownsword, who's one of our associate artists that's worked with us every year since we started in 2009. He won the Korean Biennial last year, and he's working with a Korean artist called Juri Kim. So they're doing a joint project together in Stoke, which is both at Spode, but also at the Wedgwood Museum. And then they're coming on and they're doing a joint residency at the V&A here at the V&A's ceramic residency scheme. So there's lots to see. There's also lots to do as well. We have a whole area which is called the clay pit. So you can actually come and get clay under your fingernails. You can really mess about with slip, great big sausages of clay, make work with it, which is part of our engagement programme. It's very much about doing stuff with clay. It's about demonstrations and workshops. Yeah, just come along. It's all free. Come and see us.
Ian Cartwright of the British Ceramics Biennial there, speaking to this show's very own producer, Ben Rylan. The event runs until the 5th of November in Stoke-on-Trent, right here in the UK. Next week, we'll delve into the eccentric world of North Korean graphic design and trawl through the rogue state's ticket stubs, food packaging and graphic identity.
As soon as you're flying over the river that divides China and North Korea, they start saying this is where the great leader sort of fought the Japanese occupation. So immediately, before you've even started, you've got the atmosphere of arriving in somewhere very, very different.
Section D was produced by Ben Rylan and edited by George McDonough. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, it's goodbye.